I want to pick up in April the 15th, 1919, and this is volume 12. Major things are done after minor ones, and they are the fulfillment and the crowning of these minor ones. Louisa said, I was fusing myself in the holy will of my most beloved Jesus, and together with him, my intelligence was wandering in the work of creation, adoring and thanking the Supreme Majesty for everything and everyone. You see how completely universal this prayer is. It excludes nobody. If our praying and our desire to help excludes anybody for any reason whatsoever, then it's not prayer in the divine will. The divine will includes all creatures of all times, in all conditions. Jesus said, My daughter, in creating the heavens first, I created the stars as minor spheres, and then I created the sun, the major sphere, endowing it with such light as to eclipse all the stars as though hiding them within itself, constituting the sun as king of the stars and of all nature. It is my usual way to do minor things first as preparation for major ones, and these as crowning, as the crowning of the minor ones. The sun, while being my relator, is what my book says, it means the one who proclaims the Lord, his preacher, the one who proclaims who he is. So the sun being my preacher or proclaimer also veils the souls who form their sanctity in my will. In other words, the sun is usually taken as an image of the divine will itself. And now here, it's also an image of those who live in the divine will. The saints who lived in the mirror of my humanity, that's all the saints up to the time of Louisa, and as though in the shadow of my will, they will be the stars. So that's Matthew 5:17, you're to shine like stars. And also you have the book of Daniel, chapter 12 from verse 2, that the saints will shine like stars in the kingdom of God. So the saints who lived in the mirror of my humanity, and as though in the shadow of my will, they will be the stars. The former souls, though later in time, will be the sons. So the souls living in the divine will are the sons, the souls who lived in the humanity of Christ, the stars. Jesus said, I maintained this order also in redemption. My birth was without clamour. On the contrary, it was neglected. My childhood was without splendour of great things before men, that is in the eyes of people. My life in Nazareth was so hidden that I lived as if ignored by all. I adapted myself to do the smallest and the most common things of human life. During my public life, there were a few things that were great, but still, who knew about my divinity? No one, not even all the apostles. Now notice all the apostles, because when you go to Mount Tabor, you'll find that the divinity was shown to the three apostles on Mount Tabor. And they were so impressed that Peter wanted to build three tents, one for Jesus, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, which meant that he understood nothing of what he saw. Jesus said, I passed through the crowds like any other man, so much so that anyone could come close to me, talk to me, and if needed, they could despise me, which many of them did. So Louisa interrupted Jesus, saying, Jesus, my love, how happy those times were, and happier those people who, by just wanting it, could come close to you, talk to you, and be with you. Now, that is echoed in Luke 13:27. But Jesus tells her, that's not so. He said, my daughter, only my will brings true happiness. It alone encloses all goods in the soul and makes itself the crown around the soul. It constitutes her as the queen of true happiness. Only these souls will be the queens around my throne. So that's the Song of Songs, chapter 6, verses 8 to 9. There are many concubines and there were few queens. Because they are a birth from my will. You see, all the time he's trying to get through to her the extraordinary difference between someone who has been birthed from the divine will and someone who has lived an ordinary Christian life. This is so true that those people during the days of Jesus' incarnation and who were able to touch him, like Jesus said, you know, who touched me? He said they weren't happy. Many of them saw me, but they didn't know me. Because my will did not reside within them as the center of life. And this is perfectly clear when you see the indictment that Jesus gave to the leadership of Israel in Matthew 23. Not only did they not recognize him or know him, they were totally opposed to his so-called new ideas. Therefore, even if they saw me physically, that is, but did not know me, these people who met Jesus during the days of his incarnation were not happy. Many of them saw me physically, that is, but did not know me. So they didn't know who the person of Jesus was, because my will did not reside within them as the center of life. Some of them were trying to do God's will, others were opposed. So the divine will was not there as the center of life. Therefore, even if they saw me physically, they remained unhappy. And you can see that very clearly in that episode in John chapter 8, when a group of male leaders dragged a woman along demanding her death, even though they themselves were complicit in the sin she committed. So the enormous amount of unhappiness that was there is perfectly clear. He said they remained unhappy. And only those who received the good of receiving the seed of my will in their hearts. And if they received the seed of my will in their hearts, if they disposed themselves to receive the good, they were only the ones who saw him in the resurrection. And this is why when you go to the end of the gospel and the stories of the resurrection, it's quite amazing who saw him, who recognized him and who didn't. Even among the apostles. It's quite amazing. So I give you not only the end of each of the four Gospels there, but 1 Corinthians 15 as well, where Paul gives you the story of who saw him when and in what order. Now, Jesus said, the great portent of my redemption was the resurrection, because that's when the church recognized him, which was like more than a refulgent sun. It crowned my humanity, making even my littlest acts shine with such splendor and marvel as to make heaven and earth to be astonished. So it's only in the resurrection that the apostles and the early believers realized who Jesus was. And because they realized who Jesus was, they then were able to reflect back on the other parts of his life and begin to penetrate mysteries that they had not touched before. It will be the beginning, the foundation and the fulfillment of all goods, the crown and the glory of all the blessed. My resurrection, he said, is the true sun, source of all life, grace and everything, which worthily glorifies my humanity. It is the sun of the Catholic religion. It is the glory of every Christian. Without the resurrection, it would have been as though the heavens had no sun. There was no heat, no life, no future. Now, my resurrection is the symbol of the souls who will form their sanctity in my divine will. Now, I want you, if you're, please get your book, put a VIP on this. My resurrection, Jesus said, is the symbol of the souls who will form their sanctity in my will. The saints of these past centuries were symbols of my humanity. So up to the time that this revelation is made to Louisa, all the saints have had their sanctity in the humanity of Jesus. And the church says it in her liturgy as well. Everything is through him, with him, and in him. So they're symbols of my humanity, he said. Although resigned, they did not have the continuous attitude in my will. Therefore, they did not receive the mark of the Son of my resurrection. Isn't that absolutely mind-blowing? I want to give you John 14, 12 and John 15, 7 to 8. So what did they receive? And this is the two references I've just given to you now. They received the mark of the works of my humanity before the resurrection. And you see, John 14, 12 says, my disciples will do the same works as I do when I go to the Father. So that means healing, preaching, exercising, evangelizing, loving, serving, and so on. Very interesting. So they did not receive the mark of the Son of my resurrection, but the mark of the works of my humanity before the resurrection. Therefore, they will be many, like the stars. They will form for me a beautiful ornament in the heaven of my humanity. But the saints who will be in the divine will, living in the divine will symbolize my resurrected humanity. Okay? And they will be few. Now, when you go to the St. Paul's description of the ascension of Jesus, he says there was approximately 500 people there out of all the thousands that Jesus preached to, and the myriads of people that he healed and blessed and all the rest of it, only 500 turned up. Well, out of all the people that will be exposed to this living in the divine will, not everybody will actually live in it. They may do some acts in it, but they may not actually live in it fully. And it's the people who live in it fully. These will be the few that will represent the resurrection of Jesus. In fact, he said, many throngs and crowds of people saw my humanity before its death, but few saw my resurrected humanity. And very surprising people, like even the apostles didn't think that Mary of Magdala should have seen first. That God's ways are not ours. And his way of thinking is as different from ours as the heavens are from the earth. That's Isaiah 55, verses 8 to 10. But few, he said, there were throngs and crowds to listen to him evangelizing, but only few saw his resurrected humanity. Only the believers, those who are most disposed, and I could say only those who contained the seed of my will. In fact, if they did not have it, they would have lacked the necessary sight to be able to see my resurrected and glorious humanity and therefore be spectators of my ascent into heaven. Now, as I told you, 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says that there were 500 at the ascension. Okay. Out of all those who said they wanted to follow him and be with him and be part of what he was doing and all the rest of it. When it came down to it, the number was quite small. So, if my resurrection symbolizes the saints of living in the divine will, and this with reason, because each act, each word, each step done in my will is a divine resurrection. All I can do is read this for you very slowly, and you must ask the Lord to let it sink into the depths of your being. Each act, each word, each step done in my will is a divine resurrection that the soul receives. It is a mark of glory that she undergoes. It is to go out of herself in order to enter into the divinity and to hide within the refulgent sun of the divine will. And in the divine will, she loves, she works, she thinks. So what is the wonder if the soul remains fully risen and fully identified with the very sun of my glory, and which symbolizes my resurrected humanity? Wow. But few are those who dispose themselves to this, because souls, even in sanctity, want something of their own good. That reminds me of a story attributed to St. John of the Cross. Whether he actually told it or not, I couldn't tell you. And the story is that many people stop a few yards from their goal in sanctity. And that's the tragedy. It's actually more tragic than if they had never started the journey. Let me give you a modern equivalent of that, because John of the Cross was the 16th century. So many people have attempted to climb and conquer Mount Everest. And we are told that if you could go and in a helicopter or a small aircraft, look at the trail that these mostly men have taken, you'd see it littered with all the stuff they left behind. And there are three camps on the way up. The vast amount of litter is on the first one, where people gave up at the first real block. There's more litter at the second camp. These people had persevered much more than the first, had gone through much, much more and endured much more hardship, but they gave up on the second one. But the tragedy is the bodies and the equipment that you see almost at the summit. That's the tragedy. And so you will understand then why in these writings Jesus keeps telling Louisa to persevere, to be patient, to stick at it, to be stable, to continue doing it. Because human beings are inclined to give up. And to give up at the most extraordinary points. So Jesus said, few are those who will dispose themselves to this, because even in holy things, in sanctity, they want something of their own good. They won't really surrender 100%. Adults find it extremely difficult to think that they won't be in control of what happens inside of them. While if you actually do surrender to the Lord and live in the divine will, the sanctity of living in my will has nothing of its own. Everything is of God. So we have to leave all the baggage, all the equipment, everything behind us. And we go to God, like St. Therese told us, with empty hands, and let him fill those hands with whatever he wants. While the sanctity of living in my will has nothing of its own, but everything is of God. And in order for souls to dispose themselves to this, to stripping themselves of their own goods, it takes too much. You see, people enjoy these classes. They enjoy me explaining all of this stuff to them. They agree with it. But that doesn't mean they will agree to being stripped of something they really want to hold on to. And if we hold on to anything, then the surrender is not complete. If the surrender is not complete, the final clinching of my will in the divine will permanently is not there. And if the permanent clicking of my will into the divine will doesn't happen, then all of this marvel that the Lord is talking about that goes on in the divine will won't happen to me. Yeah, I'll have moments in which I will do acts in the divine will. But that's not this sanctity in the divine will. That's not the glory that Jesus is talking about here. Therefore, Jesus said, the people in the sanctity of the divine will not be many. You are not in the number of the many, Jesus said to Louisa. You're one of the few. Therefore, be always attentive and let your flight be continuous. Because that final clicking of our will into his will means that 24/7, 365, no breaks, no holidays, no days off. It's all divine will, all the time. We just need to get our heads around that. So April the 19th, 1919, Jesus did for each soul everything that they were obliged to do for their Creator. And that's why, in imitation of him, he asks us to do reparation and substitution for our brothers and sisters who are not doing it today. So Louisa said she felt afflicted, and Jesus came and clasped her to himself and said, my daughter, what's wrong? Your affliction weighs upon my heart and pierces me more than my own pains. Poor daughter, you have sympathized with me many times, and you've taken my pains upon yourself. Now I want to sympathize with you and take your pain upon me. This is the mutual giving of love. And he clasped me all to his heart, and drawing me outside of myself, that is into an out-of-the-body experience, he added, cheer up, my daughter, come into my will to be able to better understand and see what my humanity did in souls. So it's only in this marvelous experience that Louisa can only have in this out-of-the-body experience that she can understand what the humanity of Jesus did for the rest of us. And she says, I don't know how to say what I understood. In many things I lack words. I just say what my sweet Jesus told me. So you'll learn in higher volumes that Jesus will say that he actually gave her the words. So Jesus said, my daughter, my humanity was the sole organ which reordered the harmony between the Creator and the creature. So that means that he is the only mediator between God and man. There is no other. You alone are the Holy One. You alone are the Lord. You alone are the Most High, Jesus Christ, for the glory of God. So he alone reordered the relationship between the Creator and the creatures. I did for each soul all that they were obliged to do towards their Creator, not excluding even the lost souls, because for all created things I was to give to the Father complete glory, complete love, and complete satisfaction. Notice I repeated that three times. Complete means 100%. With this difference only, that for the souls who somehow fulfill their duties towards their Creator, as almost no one arrives at satisfying them all, their glory unites to mine, and everything they do remains as though grafted into mine. While the lost souls remain as though parched members, which, lacking the vital humours, are not fit for receiving any graft of the good that I have given to them, but they're only fit for burning in the eternal fire. So that's John 15, verses 1 to 6. The branches that are useless are cut off and thrown on the fire. And also in Matthew chapter 13, verses 30, 42 and 50, the same thing is given to us in slightly different words. That the souls that have shown that they're completely useless to God, they will end up in fire. So, my humanity restored the lost harmony between the creatures and their Creator. And my humanity sealed this harmony at the price of blood and unheard of pains. And we now know, because of the material we've done, that these pains were the interior passion and the exterior passion, ad intra and ad extra. So May the 4th, 1919. Jesus has his throne on earth in the one who lives in his will. So Jesus returns to the earth in one who lives in his will. He sets up his throne in that person. That this is why we have to surrender completely. And from that person, then he rules on earth. So the more of us who come into the divine will, the more that throne is established on the earth. And what we're looking at is the return of Jesus to the earth. And we're the ones who knit the red carpet for his return. Louisa said she lived among privations and bitterness. Only the will of Jesus was her soul, strength and life. So Jesus made himself seen in my interior, she said, for a little while. So that's Luke 17:21. The kingdom of God is within you. And 1 Corinthians 3:16. So he made himself seen in my interior, all afflicted and pensive, sustaining his forehead with his own hand. In seeing him so afflicted, I said to him, Jesus, what's wrong? You're so afflicted and pensive. And he looked at me and he said, ah, daughter, from within your heart, I am allotting the destiny of the world. There's a shocker. From within your heart, I am allotting the destiny of the world. So it's his throne from where he reigns. So I want to give you Romans 8:19, that the whole of creation is crying out for these sons of God that will allow even creation itself to be healed. Jesus said, your heart is the center of my throne upon the earth. And from my center, I look at the world. I see the madness of creatures. I see the precipice which they are preparing. And I am as though put aside. That's atheism and atheistic materialism and communism and Marxism and so on. I am as though put aside, as if I were nothing for them. And I am forced to withdraw the light. Now, of course, if he withdraws the light, we are left in thick darkness. And if we're left in thick darkness, then humanity really goes mad. So I am forced to withdraw the light, not only of grace, but also of their natural reason. So if humanity goes down that far, the most unbelievable things will happen, as we know did happen, not only in Germany in the Second World War, but also with Pol Pot and Stalin and all of these incredibly cruel human beings. I am forced to withdraw the light, not only of grace, but also of their natural reason, to confound them and to make them touch with their own hands who man is. John 15:5, without me, you can do nothing. Man is only dust. But if it was even clean dust, it would help. And of course, what man can do. We know the horrors that man can do. And from within your heart, Jesus said, I look at him and I cry and I pray for ungrateful man. But I want you together with me, crying and praying and suffering for my relief. And I want your company. Now, it's an incredible thing. God's throne is in heaven. That's the centre where the Blessed Trinity reigns and where the saints live with him. On earth, he dwells in us, in souls. But he reigns, he dwells in souls, living in ordinary holiness and grace. But in the divine will souls, then he has his throne and he will rule the earth. Okay. But on that throne, he wants us together with him. So if you just look up, I think it's the book of Revelation, chapters 2 and 3, where the promise is made that if you would cooperate, he said, I will share my throne with you. That's exactly what he's doing with Louisa. He says, come, we'll do this together. God doesn't want to be alone in dealing with the earth. You see that in Genesis 1:26. You see it in Acts 7:53. You see it in Job 38, verse 7. And you see it in Proverbs 8:31, just to give you a few references. God always wants us to work with him. And the whole story of the Bible is that God called human beings like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and so on and so forth, and all the prophets and saints of the Old Testament, as well as the apostles and the saints of the New Testament, to work with him to bring about God's will upon the earth. So, Louisa said, "My poor Jesus, how much compassion I have for you. Ah, yes, I will cry and pray together with you. But tell me, my love," she said, "how is it possible that my heart be the center of your throne on the earth?" Now, I would imagine the priests are asking that question. And when there are so many good souls from in whom you dwell. And she said, "And I'm so bad." So Jesus answered, "In heaven," we're talking about God's throne now. "In heaven," he said, "I have the center of my throne, where I am the life of each one of the blessed. And by being the life of each one of the blessed, I do not exclude that I have a throne in which all my majesty, my omnipotence, immensity, beauty, wisdom, etc. reside as in a central point. And since each of the blessed cannot contain me, not having the capacity of containing all the immensity of my being." Okay, and if you go to Revelation 4, 5 and 7, chapters 4, 5 and 7, you get a description of God's throne and the four animals and the elders and then the myriads and myriads of saints and the myriads and myriads of angels as well outside of that. So God has his own centre. Now, in these writings, we've come across that centre as this singularity, this single point. So we can't pin down God to anything or anywhere. He is. It's difficult for us to sort of put words on it. And so you can see, if I can use funny language, if we were outside of time and space, we would be able to see the angels and we would be able to see the saints. But God lives in inaccessible light. And in the higher volumes, you're going to find that when Louisa is given the enormous privilege of going into that inaccessible light, even while she's on this earth, which is utterly amazing. She said she could see the angels and the saints, but she couldn't see our Blessed Mother. And she had to go deep, deep, deep into that inaccessible light to find her, because she's closest to God. So he said, "I have my throne in heaven." In the same way, he said, "On earth, I have my center. While I dwell in others, that is in grace with all the good Christians, I have my central point from which I decide, I command, I operate, I do good, I chastise." In other words, I reign. "Which I do not do in the other dwellings." Now, the other dwellings is 1 Corinthians 3:16. "Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and the Spirit of God resides in you?" That's everybody who's in the state of grace. But he said he's present there. He's not reigning on the earth there. But in someone living in the divine will, living in the center of God, God will use them as a central point from which to reign on the earth. Look at the immensity of the privilege that's offered to us. "And do you know why I have chosen you as the central place? Because I've chosen you to live life in my will." Now, to live means 24/7, 365. "And the one who lives in my will is capable of containing me completely." That's the incredible bit. Why? Because the divine will is the essence of God. The one who lives in my will is capable of containing me completely as my central point, because she lives in the center of my being and I live in the center of hers, you in me and I in you. That's John 14:20-21. But while I live in her center, I live it as if I was in my own center, because it's the divine will. And so you have the divine will living in heaven, and you have the divine will living on earth. So for each person who goes into that incredible surrender to God, then we are enabling the divine presence to return to the earth. And he will only return to sanctity. He will not return to sewerage. Sewerage belongs to the other kingdom and all the evil that goes with it. And that's why you cannot live in the divine will and have any shadow of sin. It's not actually possible. On the other hand, he said, one who does not live in my will cannot embrace me completely, naturally enough, because there's somewhere in them that doesn't belong to the divine will. Therefore, at the most, I can dwell there, but not erect my throne. In other words, they've not surrendered completely. If all understood the great good of living in my will, they would compete, he said. But alas, how few understand it. And the rest of them, they live more in themselves than in me. It's really sad. That's why it is so incredibly important to keep reading these texts, because it's only in reading them that you are exposed to the enormity of what happens to you when you surrender fully into the divine will, and the tragedy that happens if you don't. So May the 8th, 1919. The cause and the necessity of pains which the divinity gave to the humanity of Jesus, and the reason why he has delayed in making them known. So finding myself in my usual state, Louisa said, I was thinking about the pains of my adorable Jesus, especially those which the divinity made his most holy humanity suffer. So now she's talking about the interior divine passion of Jesus, the passion of love, as she describes it in the agony in the garden. Meanwhile, I felt myself being drawn inside the heart of my Jesus, and I took part in his pains. And this is divine pain. I took part in the pains of his most sacred heart, which the divinity made him suffer during the course of his life upon the earth. So the divine passion extended from the moment of conception to the moment of death. The human passion inflicted on Jesus was the last 24 hours of his life. These pains are quite different from those which Jesus suffered in the course of his passion from the hands of the Jews. And the Gentiles, of course. They are pains which almost cannot be described, naturally, because it's divine. From the little I shared in them, she said, I can say that I felt a sharp, bitter pain accompanied by a tearing of the heart itself, such that I felt myself that I was actually, genuinely dying. This was not just an experience. And then Jesus, almost with a prodigy of his love, gave me life again. Then after I suffered, Jesus said, Daughter of my pains, know that the pains which the Jews gave me were the shadow of those which the divinity gave me. Because naturally enough, the Jews are creatures. They could only give a finite thing. The divinity is limitless and could give an infinite thing. So the infinite passion is the divine one. The finite passion is the one that we look at on Good Friday. And this was just, Jesus said, in order to receive full satisfaction. Man in sinning offends the supreme majesty, not only externally but internally, and he disfigures in his own interior, the divine part which was infused in him when he was created. Okay. Now, here's the part that people don't really understand. And that is that when we sin, we not only afflict damage on others, but we afflict damage on ourselves as well. Let's take a very simple example. By simple, I mean uncomplicated. If I refuse to forgive somebody, my refusal to forgive closes my own heart. It closes me from being able to love, from being able to reach out to others. It closes me off from holiness, from growing in closeness with God. It closes me off from growing in closeness to any human being as well. The more I refuse to forgive, the more I actually kill myself. It is literally suicidal not to forgive. And many people make the excuse that, oh, I've got hurt feelings. The hurt feelings are like the carriages on the train. And it's what the driver does at the top will tell you where the train is going. And the driver is the will. You forgive people with your will, the feelings will follow. But if you're waiting for feelings, there will be no forgiveness. And forgiveness is the key to life. All of us have to forgive. Father, forgive them. They don't realize what they're doing. But of course, human nature wants to say, oh, but they do realize what they're doing. They don't, actually. They don't know the damage they're doing to themselves. They don't know the damage they're doing to the environment. They don't know the damage they're doing to creation. They don't know the damage they're doing to their own descendants. They don't. Jesus is God. He knew the truth. So, I want to give you Matthew 18, verses 23 to 35. Because there, Jesus gave this teaching in a parable. And it's the man who owed a very great debt to his king. There's no way he could possibly pay it. And so the king represents God, and the debt is the debt of sin. And even if the man was sent to jail or to slavery for the whole of his life, himself and his wife and his children, there's no way he could pay the debt. Because what you're dealing with is an infinite debt. And the only way it could be dealt with is that the king would forgive him the debt. And that's what happens to us when we go to confession. That it's the only tribunal on earth where the accused says, yes, I did it. And the judge, instead of giving you a sentence, gives you forgiveness. It's incredible, really. And once the man threw himself at the feet of the king wiped out the debt completely, instantly. Now, if I owed somebody $1 million and I had been forgiven that, I think it would take a few minutes for that to register. And for the enormity of the burden that had been lifted off me to register. And then wouldn't you think you would go back to that person and thank them with all your being for such an incredible gift? But no. Jesus knows humanity, and in these writings, human beings are continuously described as the ungrateful ones. And so this ungrateful man walked out and treated his neighbour very badly for a very, very, very small debt, which the neighbour could actually pay back. So the injustice and the lack of love and the lack of forgiveness to his neighbour had this man brought right back and condemned by the king. He wasn't condemned for his original debt, but for absolutely refusing to pass on this grace and this freedom and this love and this healing to somebody else. And so Jesus tells us here that the one who got this forgiveness for us was himself. He was the one who did the pleading with the king to get the forgiveness for the ungrateful one who was going to walk off and maltreat his neighbour badly. Jesus says that sin is formed first in the interior of man, and then it comes outside. In other words, the anger is nursed inside of us before it comes out in terrible words or terrible deeds. What comes outside, he said, is the minimum part. The greater remains in the interior. Now, Jesus is explaining here why the interior passion was in fact more necessary than the exterior one. So I want to give you Mark 7:25, that all the evil comes from our interior. Jesus said it's not the food that goes into you that makes you unclean. It's all the stuff that comes out of you that makes you unclean. I also want to give you Jeremiah 17:9-10, that the heart of man is perverse. It's crooked and it's perverse. So the biggest problem we have is in the interior. And you know that if you ever have tried to get through to anybody, that all the resistance is inside of them. It's not outside of them. Now, he said, creatures were incapable of penetrating into my interior and making me satisfy to make reparation for all of this interior stuff that we junk that we have inside of us. Creatures couldn't penetrate into Jesus' interior to make him make reparation through pain and give the glory of the Father to the Father, which the human beings had denied him in so many offences in the interior. And on our journey to total surrender in the divine will, we need to remember that the dialogue that goes on in our heads is extremely important. We might think we're holy, but just listen to the dialogue going on in your head and you'll find out whether you're holy or not. Jesus said, more so, since these offences wounded the noblest part of the creature, that is the intellect, memory and will, the three great powers of the soul, in which the divine image was imprinted. And so there's the damage that sin does. It actually attacks the engine, the intellect, the memory and the will that enables you to be able to respond or recover. Who then was to take on this commitment if the creature was incapable? No human being can pay an infinite debt. It's actually that simple. Therefore, it's almost necessary that the very divinity would take on this commitment and act as my loving executioner. And though loving, more demanding, in order to receive full satisfaction for all the sins committed in the interior of man. So I want to give you Psalm 145:17. God only ever acts out of love. God is love. He's only able to act out of love. No matter what he does, if they are chastisements, it's done out of love. No matter what he does, it's done out of love. Because what he wants in the end is that all his children, no matter what they've done on the planet, will eventually get up and come back to him. So because all the evil of man is actually in his interior, therefore, Jesus has to agree to let his interior be crucified in a way that is utterly, for me anyway, utterly mind-boggling, so that he could repair for all our thoughts, all our words, all our actions, all our motivations, all our desires, all our mental dialogues that can be completely uncharitable and so on. And then he said, the divinity wanted the complete work and the full satisfaction of the creature. So God wanted the restoration of the human race fully. He wanted the restoration of the interior and the exterior. So, In the passion which the Jews gave me, that's the finite one, I satisfied for the external glory of the Father which creatures had taken away from him. In the passion which the divinity gave me during the whole course of my life, I satisfied the Father for the sins of the interior of man. So there you have the passion that we look at on the cross, making reparation for all the exterior sins of man, and then the interior passion making reparation for all the interior sins of man. And since that took 33 years of Jesus' life, that's the biggest part of it. And this is a complete new revelation for us. From this, you will understand how the pains which I suffered from the hands of the divinity surpassed by far the pains which creatures gave me. Even more, they almost cannot be compared, and they are less accessible to the human mind, of course. We just can't grasp it. Just as there is a great difference between the interior and the exterior of man, much greater is the difference between the pains which the divinity inflicted upon me and those which creatures gave me on the last day of my life. The first ones were cruel tearings, superhuman pains, capable of giving me death, and repeated deaths in the most inmost parts, both of soul and body. Not even a fibre was spared me. The second one, that's the exterior one, were bitter pains, but not tearings, capable of giving me death at each pain. But the divinity had the power and the will to do so. All we can do is meditate on this. It's just incredible. How much man costs me, Jesus said. But man is ungrateful and he doesn't care about me. And he doesn't try to understand how much I have loved him and suffered for him. So much so that he's not even come to understand all I suffered in the passion that creatures gave me. So what Jesus is saying is, in the past 2,000 years, we have not even come to understand what he did on Calvary. We've not even bothered to find out the depths of what he actually suffered for us in the exterior passion. And if they don't understand the lesser, how can they understand the greater, which I suffered for them? This is why I delay in revealing the innumerable and unheard of pains which the divinity gave me because of them. But my love wants its outpouring, and it wants its the requital of its love. Therefore, I call you in the immensity and the height of my will. That's the summit, the highest point of my will, where all these pains are alive now, in act. And not only do you take part in them, but in the name of the whole human family, you honour them, you give them the requital of love. And together with me, you substitute for all that creatures owe. But to my highest sorrow and to the greatest harm for themselves, they don't even give it a thought. I'll stop on that pretty frightening note.